Good afternoon. I will call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 2:19 p.m., Wednesday, January 31st, 2024. I'd like to thank Juliana Singh with Senate Records for keeping our minutes, and Dylan Williams for running the sound. We appreciate their work. Also like to thank the chairman's staff, Brianna Cockrock, for all her work setting up and getting the word out. And thanks to our testifiers and presenters for your patience today after a long floor session. We appreciate you standing by and waiting. this time, let me remind both committee members and those in the room, please silence your cell phone. Joining me this afternoon, I have Senator Tobin, Senator Giesel, and I am Senator Jesse Kiel, vice chair. With three members present, we have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business today is recognizing Senator Kaufman has also joined us. And then after that, we will take up first Executive Order 133, an executive order eliminating the Criminal Justice Information Advisory Board. Here to present is Lisa Purinton for the Department of Public Safety, unless she would also like to bring the commissioner up at her discretion. If the department will come forward, please feel free to introduce yourself for the record, and when you're ready, start your remarks.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Vice Chair Keogh, and members of the committee for allowing us to present a little information about the Governor's Executive Order 133. My name is Lisa Purinton. I'm the Director for the Division of Statewide Services within the Department of Public Safety. This order would primarily impact my division, so that's why I'm presenting on this. And we also have, of course, Commissioner Cockrell here with the Department of Public Safety. So we'll go ahead and get started. So with this executive order, the Department of Public Safety currently already has some statutory guidelines that references some of the duties that are kind of duplicative in the Criminal Justice Information Advisory Board. The executive order will effectively transfer the duties of the Criminal Justice Information Advisory Board to the Department of Public Safety. And so I wanted to give you a little bit of information about the background of the current requirements the Department of Public Safety already has in statute. So part of it right now is under Alaska Statute 1262.110 for the duties of the commissioner. And two of the key areas I pulled out here under this statute is to operate a criminal justice information system to serve as the state central repository for criminal history. The department has been doing this. The system we currently have has been in place. The current system has been in place since the late 80s. It is on a legacy mainframe system. We'll get into that a little bit more as we go through the presentation. So the department does maintain the state's criminal history repository, as has been testified in a number of hearings. While the court system certainly adjudicates the cases, the Department of Law prosecutes the cases, it's the Department of Public Safety that actually the final resting spot for all of those criminal history records resides in the criminal histories repository that the department maintains. And part of 1262.110 also requires the department to coordinate with other agencies on the reporting requirements to get the data into the system. To also work with other state criminal history repositories that are equivalent to what the state of Alaska has, and also to coordinate with the national repository that's maintained by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And so with that, those requirements, it's to develop and operate an effective interstate, national, and international system of criminal record identification, the records and statistics. And so that's something the department already has to do in statute. There's a number of statutes that the department is required to abide by, as are agencies that contribute data to the repository to make sure that the information is complete, accurate, who has access to the information, when the information can be released, what to do if there's an error in the criminal record, as well as the very rare situations where you have a sealing or purging of criminal justice information. So those are all outlined to make sure that the repository is as complete, accurate, and the data is fed into the system as timely as possible. So with the executive order, as I mentioned, it would transfer the duties of the Criminal Justice Information Advisory Board. We are the government. We like our acronym, so I'll be referring that to the CJAB from this point forward, because to say the name of the board is kind of a mouthful. So with the CJAB, some of the duties in there, as I mentioned, were to coordinate with and to advise the department and other agencies on reporting the data. As I mentioned, there's already statutory requirements to do so. And with that requirement, as an example of the duties that are being transferred, is exactly that, that the Department of Public Safety would have to advise criminal justice agencies on matters pertaining to the development and operation of the central repository. Again, restating what the statutes already require them to do, as far as reporting arrest data and disposition data and warrant information. And as an example of what we're doing to kind of show that advisement and the communication that we're doing, we're currently, as I mentioned, the repository currently sits on a legacy mainframe system that's been around since the late 80s. And so the department has been undertaking a five-year project to replace that repository, primarily using federal funding to replace the repository. I believe we're in year three for this year, going into our five-year project. So as we're going through the discovery phase, you can imagine, maybe you can't imagine because the system is so old, but the repository, the mainframe has been adapted over the last 40 years. And so we're trying to take that all apart to make it into a modern system. So we're working with our vendor to undertake that discovery process to make sure we have no degradation in the existing data, that we can pull in the existing records and make, you know, a move so that the platform is adaptable for current technology platforms. And through this process, obviously, there are several partner agencies that we have in the state. I mentioned the Department of Law, the court system, the local police departments, other state agencies, pretty much all levels of law enforcement in the state access this system, either through a user-direct interface or through an automated interface system with those other departments' internal data management systems as well. And this system is also used to, it's our connection to the world, so that we can then contact other state repositories to see if that person has a driver's license in Florida, or if they have a warrant in Texas, or if they've been a convicted sex offender out of Florida. So it allows us to connect to those other systems. So as this, because it has such a huge impact, as we're going through this process, we've been very diligent and having a communication plan and working with all of those partner agencies to let them know where we are in the process and letting them know how this would impact their systems. And as we get closer to actually having a testing system ready to go live, then we'll be doing training with the agencies and working with them on how they're going to access the system. So, so this is somewhat of a sectional, if you will, for the executive order, talking about what it's going to remove. It obviously will amend AS 1262-100. It removes the two sections referring to the department's requirement to consult with the CJAB on matters related to criminal justice information systems. It will amend 1262-120A by removing the requirement for the DPS commissioner to consult with the CJAB, requiring the responsibility for reporting information to the repository. And it will amend 1262-150C by removing the requirement for DPS to provide audit findings to the CJAB. It does not remove the requirement for the department to conduct audits of the system. So that does not go away with this. It just removes the requirement for the department to report this to this board, because the board will no longer exist. And then, of course, repealing the actual references to the board in 1262-100 and 1262-900. And kind of the benefits for the department is that the CJAB has been ineffective and it's somewhat duplicative. As I mentioned, there's already statutory requirements for what this board was supposed to do that the department is already required to do. Other states, other agencies are required to do by the existing statutes. The board has been very sporadic in its meetings. In 2013, it actually had four meetings. And then since 2013, so basically 2014, it has only had four meetings since then. So clearly there's not a lot of effectiveness that can be done when the board is meeting so inconsistently to affect matters pertaining to criminal justice information systems. The other thing is where I'm referencing the duplicativeness of this board is that the Department of Public Safety has an agreement with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and each state is required to have a designated criminal justice information services systems agency, the CSA. And the Department of Public Safety is the CSA for the state of Alaska. And why the FBI requires that is because they also want to make sure that information from state systems that is fed into the national system is complete, accurate, and timely. And so that's where, as the department, the CSA, we partner with all of the criminal justice agencies in the state to ensure that their systems also comply with those federal requirements for maintaining the security, accuracy, and confidentiality of that data. So everybody's ensures that we're meeting the federal standards to make sure that the information is only disseminated as authorized by state or federal law, that users only have access that complete a background check, that the information technology that supports and protects this data is meeting the federal compliance requirements for this criminal justice information systems. So again, what the CJAB was doing, the FBI is already doing and requires the department to do in order for us to meet the requirements of the agreement with them as the CSA for the state. And the FBI will also audit us every 3 years, as well as some of the criminal justice agencies that are randomly selected to ensure that we're complying with those requirements. And the FBI also requires the state to audit those criminal justice agencies. And that's why I mentioned the audit requirement is not going away. We will continue to audit the agencies to ensure that data is complete and accurate.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question on this slide, as I know the last few meetings of CJAB, CJAB dealt with fingerprinting. And I'm curious how the department plans to proceed with those pieces if CJAB is not there.
Great question. Through the chair to Senator Tobin, fingerprinting is a significant issue for the criminal history records. To get a little technical, a person can get arrested today and they can be cited and released. They're given a citation or a summons to appear in court. And sometimes that individual is told to go to the Department of Corrections to get fingerprinted and then to pay their fine and go. And some folks don't follow up with that requirement to go and get fingerprinted. Or there can be a variety of reasons within the correctional facility when a person is being booked in that person doesn't get fingerprinted. And if that information is not fingerprint supported to verify the biometrics to prove who that person is, we are not allowed to disseminate that information outside the state of Alaska. So that can be a significant issue when you can think of some of your severe felony person crimes in particular, that you could have somebody convicted of a homicide or convicted of a sex offense. And because they were never fingerprinted, that information can't be released outside the state of Alaska. So we're always very diligent trying to make sure that we're getting that information into the system and working with our agencies. We have a group of individuals within the Department of Public Safety that manages our criminal history records that come in from the court. And when they will get felony judgments from the courts, they will check our system to see if we have fingerprints on file for that person. And if we don't, then we reach out to the Department of Corrections and saying, hey, this person fell through the cracks while they're still in your custody. Can you please get those fingerprints for them so that then we're closing that gap for anybody that may have fallen through the system to make sure that those fingerprints are taken for all of our felony crimes. We also work with the Department of Corrections and their Division of Probation and Parole and Pretrial to work with their folks when they have someone that's on their client list and for whatever offense they're on probation, supervised probation for at that time, that they'll check the system to see if they have fingerprints on file for that particular event. And if not, then they will get those fingerprints as well. So we continue to work with them on that. We also work with the grants opportunities that we have through the federal system. One of those is the National Criminal History National Criminal History Improvement Program, NCHIP, again with their acronyms. And that one is we just recently in our, not this current year, but the prior year's grant cycle, we worked with Department of Corrections to get additional live scan devices for them. We will work with municipalities to get additional live scan devices so that they could have those live scan devices, the electronic fingerprinting. devices. And so when those need to be replaced, then we will use federal funding to purchase those devices, and then we work with the organizations to make sure they provide that, the maintenance contracts for that. So we're always constantly trying to work with them, from funding assistance or policy improvements or just general training and other assistance that we can provide.
Please proceed.
And this is some of the other, as I mentioned to Senator Tobin's question, we have a lot of informal as well as formal groups that we meet with on a routine basis. Here's some of the ones that I just wanted to list out to show how we are communicating with all of our partner organizations. The Alaska Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission, the Criminal Justice Working Group. There's Alaska's Multi-Agency Justice Integration Consortium. These will meet either monthly, they will meet quarterly, they will meet semi-annually. And so we're constantly working on how we can, again, improve the accuracy, completeness of the criminal justice information systems, and in particular, the central repository, which contains the criminal history records. And that's for in-state, and a couple that I just mentioned for the national, as I mentioned, the FBI is kind of our governing body as well. And so we also work with those national organizations as well to make sure that we're using best practices and leveraging the successes of other states and how they've implemented different processes and procedures to improve their systems. And this is just, again, talking about some of our data sharing. We actually have formal agreements with our organizations. And through those agreements, in order, they have to sign the agreement in order to have access to the data, whether direct access or through an interface of the system. So, and through those agreements, that's how the agencies are agreeing to comply with and abide with those policy measures that we mentioned to ensure the integrity of the data. So, and this is just kind of a quick summary. Streamline operations. Again, the board is somewhat duplicative, and the department is already doing a lot of the duties and actually exceeding the requirements of what is in the CJAB. And so that is not going to be any detriment to the department. There's not going to be an increase in workload. We're already currently doing it. And because we're able to do a lot more of it, boots on the ground, so to speak, at a lower level, working with the organizations to impact change. And then as we run into any roadblocks or barriers, then we can elevate that up through the command structure at whatever organization to make sure that we're making that difference and getting the information to the folks that need it to make change and improve the accuracy of their data. The board, again, hasn't been active in a number of years, and it's been sporadic for when it did have those bouts of activity. We've already got developed communication strategies, as I mentioned, some of the formal working groups that we're part of, and then informally just as part of our routine audits. We provide training on the system. Generally, it's every quarter. We're offering training somewhere in the state. We do both in-person training as well as virtual training to make sure agencies are aware of all of those requirements and how to use the system. Cost efficiency, this is not going to be any additional cost to the department. This is work that's already ongoing to the department. It would actually be a cost decrement because we're not paying for board members to travel around and to attend these meetings. So there's a little cost savings, if you will. And then, of course, the enhanced accountability, because we're constantly doing it, and the FBI is providing those audits for us. We're auditing the agencies, and we're also required to conduct external audits of the repository. So we've got, a double format, if you will, for making sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure that data is complete and accurate. Because it impacts everyday people that have to come in and get a background check for a variety of reasons, and we want to make sure that data is complete and accurate as it can, and make sure that it's kept confidential, just like, HIPAA requirements for medical records. We treat it the same level of confidentiality and securely when it comes to criminal justice information. That's it.
Questions for the department? I've got a couple. There's an interesting dynamic with your criminal justice information systems in which some of the agencies that interface most are effectively partners, right? You've got the court system and another branch of government. You've got perhaps juvenile justice or corrections. You have others whom you regulate, right? So local government, law enforcement, for instance. Probably some others. And then, of course, you have those who push rules down, like the FBI. You described having a lot of rules. It seems that the purpose of the board is to ensure that there's communication and collaboration before rules get made and decisions get made. And I especially think about a local government entity that has to pay the price tag, or court system that has to install equipment. And so without, I understand there hasn't been a formalized or use of the formalized structure for a while, but without a formalized structure to consult and collaborate, how do we avoid a top-down, we'll just tell you what the rules are approach?
To the chair, great question. And the department has always had a very good collaborative partnership with these organizations. And I would venture to say the CJEP hasn't been effective, so they haven't had that voice in the last almost decade. Mm-hmm. And yet the department is still functioning and still has those really good relationships with the organizations. And we're responsive to their needs as well. For example, we just recently completed a project working with tribal organizations to allow us to enter tribal protective orders into the system. The state system was set up for state protective orders, so they are set up to mirror pretty much verbatim the state domestic violence protective orders that are issued. And so it wasn't set up to be capable of handling something that wasn't specific to state laws. And so we worked with the organizations to set up the system so it can have that capacity to add that information into the system for those choosing to do so. We recently, well, it's not really recently, it's been a little while, we had partnered with the Alaska court system. They had developed a pilot project in Fairbanks for a bail repository, and which was a phenomenal project that we loved. And what it was is when they had a person that was out on conditions of release, bail conditions, that information was put into a bail repository in the court system, and our system was set up to have a direct interface into that court system, so that was giving real-time data to the officers in the field for that project. We worked with the municipal prosecutor's office several years back where they had a project with the Anchorage Police Department to enter domestic violence conditions, and so to make data entry easier for the municipal prosecutor's office that was doing the data entry in this system, you know, we set up a series of codings and shortcuts that would allow them to have a message that would alert law enforcement that the person was on domestic violence bail conditions and to who to contact on there without having to do a lot of data entry. So we're responsive to the needs of our partner organizations to try and streamline processes and to make sure the system works for their needs as well. If that answers your question.
It gets close. I guess as I was looking into this, I think one of the stories from when this group was active, meeting the statutory requirement to meet, I think, I'll get the details wrong, but DMV had stopped collecting some data that law enforcement expected to have in APSIN, or had stopped reporting it into APSIN. And my understanding is that by having a group with regular meetings, somebody from admin, folks from public safety, they were able to catch that before it became a big holes in the data in APSIN. What structures would you replace that with?
Well, I'm not familiar with the specifics on what you're referencing. I know through our modernization project to replace the current repository, we have worked with DMV because they do provide driver's license information that is fed into the system. And so that's very critical data, obviously, for law enforcement. And one of the issues we had a few years ago with DMV was they were changing the way vehicle registrations were done. So if you were of a certain age or you lived in a particular area, you could provide some information to the Division of Motor Vehicles, and then you had basically lifetime registration. Your registration never expired on your vehicle. And so that the Division of Motor Vehicles did that. Obviously, some people really benefited from them and really enjoyed that. But when the data was being fed into our system, we weren't getting anything that said non-expiring. So it would have the last expiration date, which is going to be a problem for law enforcement because they're going to see that individual with an expired license plate, which is going to be grounds for a traffic stop. when really they had a non-expiring license plate. So we worked with DMV to work out the data mapping issues on there. And if we run into issues on there, then we elevated up the chain. So it would go up to from the CGIS Systems Agency, the Bureau Chief who manages the repository. If they couldn't resolve it at that level, then it would go to the Division Director. And if that couldn't get resolved, then it would go up to the Deputy Commissioner or the Commissioner for DOA as well as DPS. We've had situations, luckily it's very few and far between, where we have those issues that need to get elevated up that chain, but we have utilized that process when we've run into an impasse where we cannot come to a resolution that is suitable for both parties.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Byrne. Oh, Commissioner, please.
Through the chair, James Cockrell, Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. I just wanted to put on record that me as the commissioner is supportive of this. We have way too many commissions and or councils that were task saturated, were past capacity for my staff and myself and my deputy commissioner to make all these meetings that a lot of time are very seldom fully attended. And I have full confidence in Department of Public Safety, and our history proves the fact that we work with other agencies to ensure that the data that is necessarily needed for seizures and for our public safety information, we'll make it work. And I see this as a good thing for our department. It's just one less responsibility that we have that we get zero funding for.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for allowing me to talk.
Our second order and final order of business for judiciary this afternoon is Executive Order 135, which would eliminate the Alaska Safety Advisory Council. I believe we have Chief Elaine Banda. Sorry about that. Try and get that right in the future. From the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Ms. Banda, if you'll identify yourself for the record, and whenever you're ready, you can begin your remarks.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to present here today. For the record, my name is Elaine Banda. I'm the Chief of Alaska Occupational Safety and Health, the Consultation and Training Division for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Chair Keel, members of the committee, I'd like to begin by giving a brief overview of the Alaska Safety Advisory Council, commonly known as ASAC, and that's what I'll refer to as ASAC, the Governor's Safety and Health Committee, as well as my role in both. ASAC is comprised of volunteers from around the state who share a common interest in the safety and health of Alaskans and the Alaska workforce. These volunteers are appointed by the governor and come from various industries, many in the safety industry. For the past several years, their primary function has been to host the Governor's Safety and Health Conference. Now, under the umbrella of the ASAC, the council seeks additional volunteers to assist with sponsoring the annual conference. These members make up the Governor's Safety and Health Committee. I have been a member of the committee since 2012, and in 2020, I was appointed by the governor to ASAC. As I stated, the main responsibility of ASAC and the Governor's Safety and Health Committee is to host the annual conference. According to statute, which is also outlined in the executive order, there are 15 additional responsibilities that are required by ASAC. These duties are outlined in the Executive Order 135, Section 18.60.030. I want to give you a little snippet of some of these duties, because we're talking 15. So A few duties are to plan and execute programs such as educational and campaigns to reduce accidents, study ways to prevent accidents on streets, highways, in the water, and in homes, confer with public agencies responsible for safeguarding accidents, specifically with the Department of Transportation, Department of Education and Early Development, Department of Health and Social Services, and various other entities. In addition to these duties, ASAC is also tasked with making recommendations to the governor and the legislature on achievements of a coordinated safety policy and program for the safety and health of Alaskans. The ASAC and the Governor's Safety and Health Committee are predominantly comprised of individuals who work full-time jobs, and they volunteer their spare time to come together to host this conference, which takes at least 7 or 8 months. They simply do not have enough time to do all these 15 additional duties that is outlined in statute. And I've been a part of the committee since 2012, and the most people can do is work on the conference. So by transferring these responsibilities of the ASAC under the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, this will ensure that an entity is held accountable to carry out these duties. So I'm going off script. It's kind of like the gentleman before me said, it's volunteers. If we're lucky, if we can get 8 or 9 people to show up, and we're talking about years, other than the conference, if any of these duties, if we're supposed to do any of those duties, there's nobody held accountable to make sure. We talked about campaigns or going out to other agencies. There's nobody held accountable to ensure all these duties are being done. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Questions from committee members.
Uh-oh.
Senator Tobin. She's the friendly one. It's okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate this. It's helpful to hear. And I, too, having served in a position where my chief responsibility was managing volunteers, understand the struggles that your department is facing and those real components when there is no one to do the work or the folks who step up to do the work don't complete it, it falls upon your shoulders. And so I appreciate and thank you for your service. However, I think there's this complexity of volunteers do bring in additional expertise and insight and also citizen engagement, particularly in our government. And I'm a big advocate of citizen engagement. So I see here as I'm looking through the council is that they have a membership from multiple sectors, industry, municipal, other folks, and I'm curious of how will you bring that expertise in if you eliminate the council?
Well, there's a plan. So it's a vision. If we have the Department of Labor, that's the department that will be held accountable. We're still going to seek volunteers. We're still going to go out and ask the public to participate in campaigns, all the things that we're not doing. But we need to have an entity. It's kind of like with the state. We have the federal government that they're overseeing all our work to make sure we're on task. With the ASAC, and I'm not sure what that would be called, but we would still want volunteers to come in and help with all these additional duties besides putting together the Governor's Safety and Health Conference. And that's the part that we want to fulfill. And some of the duties that are outlined, so I'm one half of ACOSH. I'm the consultation and training side. The other half is the enforcement side. So volunteers don't have the authority to enforce. But our enforcement side, they're already doing that anyway. Some of the campaigning, if you've heard of consultation and training, we're out there. We're already in the community. We have different programs. If you've ever heard of the Voluntary Protection Program or the START program or the CHASE program, we're already out there doing a lot of this work. But what we would do is streamline some of these duties and have a body that's oversees, I hate to use the word, but oversees our the volunteers, but someone to make sure the work is getting done. Right now, we just don't have that.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that brings me to my next question, or my follow-up question, is, and a little bit of a history, my very first job out of college was as a volunteer coordinator for Boys and Girls Clubs. Loved the training that I received, the professional development my organization provided to me, and also the recognition that that takes work. You got to pay someone to do it. And unfortunately, in this EO, we don't have a fiscal note attached that outlines what additional capacity your department needs to do that really critical volunteer management work. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
I can talk a little bit, but I'd have to get back. Oh, for the through the chair.
I see that.
Through the chair. I can talk a little bit about that, a source funding. There is the Governor Safety and Health Conference, there is funding available for that. It's always there. It's in the budget. But as far as the cost, I would have to get back with you on that because I don't know.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Chief Bend, if I'm reading the budget documents right, there is some funding. It's flat in the governor's budget. What's the position count for the council?
They're looking at, so when you say the position count for the council or the, if we transfer the duties, the position count, I'll answer both.
Perfect.
The council, they're supposed to be a 14-member staff with 14 members from various industries. As far as the position, if ASAC is eliminated and transferred, there would be three positions that we would be looking at. Now, what they're going to cost, I don't know. But three positions, one would be like a liaison, a project manager, and then an administrative assistant that would house the duties of ASAC. Now, yeah, what that would cost, I don't know.
Okay. Senator Giesel.
So is this council fully fleshed out now? Do you have 14 members?
No, we do not. I think we're up to 8 active members. And we just had 2 appointed maybe 2 or 3 months ago. Yeah, I'll say 9, but I'm being generous through the record, through the chair.
Thank you. It's
I'm being generous if I say 8 or 9. But we have a good 5 active members. And I'm one of them, but I work for the state. You know, five, they're always there, always showing up when we're supposed to have 14.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Banda, for your presentation and for taking committee questions.
All right, thank you.
This afternoon. That concludes our business for the day. For just the information of the members, if there is interest on any of the governor's executive orders in legislative disapproval, a Senate special concurrent resolution would need to be introduced. And so if any member is interested in that, a discussion either with me or with the chair upon his return would be in order. So we can have those discussions. Oh, Senator Geisel.
So, Mr. Chairman, I know there was some discussion about the committees that heard these EOs writing up a brief summary of what they found out. Perhaps we could ask staff to do that, just so there's some record. For example, this Lays Council should have 14 members. They have, generously speaking, 9. You know, that kind of information, just for the rest of the members of the Senate.
I will work with the chair on having his staff put that together, but I think that's in order. We can put that out. Anything further to come before the committee today? Seeing nothing, the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting scheduled for Friday, February 2 at 1:30 is canceled. Senator Klayman's office will provide updates about our next meeting. With no other business, we will adjourn at 3 p.m.